Murphy from the Institute of Psychiatry in London, and he will be speaking to us about serotonin and serotonin risk genes in autism. So, Declan?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. It's lovely to be here. Apologize if I and a lot of the British people who are amongst you look tired. It's not the flight. We've all been to a royal wedding for the last month or so. And if you see Patrick Bolton at the reception, just ask him about the new dress he bought himself for the wedding. Okay. So following on from what Dan was saying, that before you get into the fMRI experiment, you've kind of got to know what it is that you're investigating. So you've got to ask questions like, is this neurochemical system of relevance to the disorder that I'm interested in? Number one. And number two is, well, what potential genetic effects may there be? So for step one, what I'm going to do in this talk is, for those of you who aren't aware, I'm going to firstly briefly describe what is serotonin. Then I'm going to say, well, what's the evidence that genetic variation in genes of relevance to serotonin actually modulate brain anatomy or brain function in individuals who don't have autism? And then I'll say, well, what's the evidence that individuals with autism have abnormalities in serotonin? And then lastly, I'll say, well, what's the evidence that genetic variation of genes implicated in serotonin actually modulate brain in autism? I hope that makes sense. The reason I've done it that long and complicated way is because if I just showed you the autism and serotonin gene slides, there'd only be three of them, okay? So what is serotonin, first of all? Serotonin is a crucial brain chemical. It affects both brain function and brain development. The source of serotonin is dietary tryptophan. That tryptophan is converted to 5-hydroxytryptophan and then to serotonin, where it's stored in vesicles. So the primary rate-limiting step is the hydroxylation phase, which is under tight genetic control. Then what happens? Well, the serotonin is then either broken down by monoamine oxidase into 5-HIAA here, or it's taken up into the synaptic vesicle by the vesicular monoamine transporter. Then from the vesicle, it then goes through exocytosis into the synaptic cleft, where it then goes over the postsynaptic surfaces and then is reuptaken and broken down again. So this reuptake is modulated by the 5-HT transporter and broken down again by monooxidase A, which is also under genetic control. So a chemical system which has got tight genetic control at a number of key pinch points. In terms of its neurodevelopmental trajectory, the ascending system comes out from the dorsal raphe nucleus, ascends up through the striatum into frontal cortex, which is of great relevance, obviously, to autism, not particularly to people like myself and Dan, who don't have much of a frontal cortex, but to the rest of the human population, of great relevance. So what then is the evidence that serotonin modulates things of interest to us who are interested in autism? Well, serotonin modulates key brain functions and behaviors, for example, aggression and hostility, affect recognition, social affiliative behaviors, social hierarchies in animals, so a large input into social domain. There's also a large input into some of the stereotypic and obsessional behaviors, and there's some evidence, albeit controversial evidence, that some individuals with autism, particularly in adulthood perhaps, respond to treatment with SSRIs. So that's the brain functional aspects. Serotonin, as I've told you, also has key aspects in brain development, in cell division, in neuronal survival, in synaptogenesis, and in neurite outgrowth. And for example, here you can see cultures grown with alone with no serotonin on the far left, grown with serotonin in the middle, and with a 5-HT1B agonist on the far right-hand side. And what you can see there is quite strong neurite outgrowth. So brain chemical, crucial to brain function, under high genetic control, and also crucial to brain development. So therefore, for those of you who are thinking, brilliant, I'm now going to run off and do a genetic experiment, hold on, because there's also very significant non-genetic effects of serotonin that we've got to bear in mind. And there's been a fantastic paper recently from Pat Levitt's group, which described the placenta as a source of serotonin to embryo, particularly between the stages of hindbrained and forebrain development. So don't just think genes, also think of other potential modulatory effects on serotonin during brain development, including placental factors. So the transporter then, what's the evidence in the non-autistic population that the transporter is associated with modulation in brain anatomy or brain function? Well, as you heard earlier, there's some landmark studies from Hariri showing that the S allele is associated with greater amygdala activation, and that was a replicated study. That's great, and that was a wonderful first step. The next step, though, was to say, well, is it also associated with the differences in the connectivity of the amygdala? And the answer to that is, well, yes, it appears to be as well. And that's been borne out by some meta-analyses. So this is the slide that Susan showed you earlier on, just to reinforce a really nice, relatively robust effect of the transporter polymorphism on amygdala reactivity, being replicated by quite a few labs. This is also showing a significant relationship between connectivity between amygdala and frontal regions, and also in terms of volume of the cingulate and amygdala. That's terrific, but then the question is, well, you've got these functional differences. Why have you got these functional differences? Is that functional difference because you have a developmental difference in the amygdala itself? Or is it that you have a difference in other neural systems which feed into the amygdala? Or is it that you, functional systems, or is it you've also got associated differences in anatomical systems which are related to the amygdala? There's a lovely paper which came out just recently in the Journal of Neuroscience showing an association between transported polymorphisms and the fractional anisotropy. That means the sort of microstructural integrity of the white matter tract, the uncinate fasciculus, which connects up amygdala to frontal regions. So that's great evidence so far. But then the next question is, well, you know, it's not just the amygdala, it's not just neural systems around that regions. What about other regions, systems which impact on the amygdala? And Simon Zuglazi showed that actually transporter polymorphisms also significantly modulate the function of fusiform gyrus and the connectivity of fusiform gyrus to frontal regions and also to medial temporal regions. So the story isn't just the amygdala, and we don't know whether the difference in function in the amygdala is primary or secondary to other differences in other neural systems. So that's a transporter. What about monoamine oxidase A? There's not that robust associations, at least in a healthy population, with amygdala volume with monoamine oxidase A and transported polymorphisms rather between the high activity allele or the low activity allele. There is, though, some pretty good evidence being replicated by the same group showing that there's an association with your monoamine oxidase L or H phenotype and different aspects of frontal lobe anatomy. And this is where it gets a little bit anorakish if you're not an imager. And one of the key findings from this group is that if you have a difference in volume, for example, that difference can be driven by a difference in cortical thickness or surface area. And so what this group are doing is then taking it to the next step and saying there's a volumetric difference, but what is that due to? And that's important because the surface area and cortical thickness have got different embryological underpinnings. So moderately good evidence about the high activity allele and MAOA in terms of orbital frontal cortex anatomy. In function, there's been some pretty good studies on the association of the high activity allele and differences in the connectivity and function of the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, and also in the function of the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex during some memory tasks. Of particular relevance, though, for those of you who are going to be thinking about carrying out studies in individuals with autism, there have been some recent findings suggesting, though, that the effect of genotype associations differs by age, as Dan talked about earlier on, and particularly the monoamine oxidase findings are detectable in adult populations, but not in child populations. So that's working alone. The next step, of course, is to say, well, we need to be thinking about systems, neurochemical systems, and the enzymes which impact throughout that system. And the next step has been taken by Passamonti and colleagues, in which they've been looking at not just the effect of monoamine oxidase, but also the interactive effect of the serotonin transporter. So if you remember the system I described to you earlier on, of tryptophan coming in, being made into serotonin, then being taken up or broken down by monoamine oxidase, they've been now beginning to try and look at the interaction between those genetic effects. So that's in the healthy population. Is any of that applicable to individuals with autism? And I'm going to go through it in the hierarchy of saying, well, what's the evidence that there's a genetic association between serotonin genes and autism? Now, like with any genetic findings using GWAS, it's moderately controversial no matter which gene you look at, but I think there's consensus that there is an association between some serotonergic genes and autistic spectrum disorder, albeit weak, and particularly perhaps the MAOA genes. What's the evidence that individuals with autism themselves have got abnormalities in the serotonergic system? I think, again, that the evidence differs depending on the population you look in, but there's consensus, I think, that there's a proportion of individuals with autism who have hyperserotonemia, and they have differences in their 5-HT2A receptor binding in platelets. Not all individuals, but some individuals. There's also some fairly good evidence from studies of children showing that young children with an autistic spectrum disorder have got differences in serotonin synthesis. And lastly, we reported in young adult populations that individuals with an autistic spectrum disorder have got differences in 5-HT2A receptor binding, and that was associated with their abnormal social behaviours. And colleagues in Yale and in Canada, from Goldberg and colleagues, also found a similar result in the family, in the parents of individuals with an autistic spectrum disorder, group-wise. So that's coming up to what's the genetic findings, and this is the three slides that you've all been waiting for within individuals with an autistic spectrum disorder. With regard to the transporter, the findings are not in agreement. So the original study by Wasink and colleagues from University of North Carolina, together with colleagues in Seattle, in a landmark study, showed that there was a significant association between variation in your transporter polymorphism, whether you're long-long, short-long, or short-short, and brain volume, and particularly frontal lobe volume, in a young population aged between 2 and 4 years. Rasnahan, in contrast, looked at a slightly older population, much older population, of a wider age range, and they found no association between the transporter polymorphism and brain volume at all in individuals with autism. In terms of, and I'll show you these diagrams in a sec, in terms of MAOA, there's some initial evidence that there's an effect within individuals with autism of your low activity allele, but not in healthy controls. And that is that within autism, if you have the low activity allele, there's an association with an increase in overall brain size, as opposed to if you have the high activity allele. So this is the data from Wasink's group showing a really nice finding found both in UNC and in Seattle. The UNC are the little diamonds, and University of Washington are the circles. That's in the young population. This is in the adult population on the left-hand side of the graph there, or I should say really older population. No significant association whatsoever, and actually no overall increase in brain volume within that population either. And on the far right, what you see is the data from Davis and colleagues, and on the bottom what you'll see is the association within individuals with autism only and not within the healthy controls. Low MAOA activity allele, and the high activity allele having a lower brain volume. So What have I said to you in summary? Serotonin is absolutely crucial for brain development and function in the healthy population. Serotonin is also significantly implicated in autistic spectrum disorder. But it's not all genes. Don't just think that, you know, I can get a genetic impact on this. What we need to be doing in terms of the future is thinking about, as Dan said, not just regional-based approach, but systems-based approaches, asking questions like, at what age would I expect this neural system to be most relevant to be studied, and at what age would I expect the maximal impact of that genetic variation to be interacting with that system? You also want to be thinking about what gestational age that system might be most affected by whatever genetic variation it is that you're looking at. The things that we've not done so far have really been looking at epistasis in a decent way. And the other thing that we've not been doing so far is saying we found these associations between genetic variation and differences in brain function or anatomy, but we're not actually asking why is that, so in a very coherent way. So, for example, we've not yet put together pharmaco-fMRI studies together with genetic studies to ask how is it that these differences in function arise and how can we modulate them. And those are the next steps. With that, I'll finish and thank you for your attention.
Okay, we have time for a few questions, and if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you about some of the environment interactions. In particular, some of the prior studies on the serotonin transporter, well, I guess along with some other genes done primarily in Danny Weinberger's group, suggested that you may not see differences with the different allelic variants in the absence of an environmental trigger of some point, of some nature, and that, for example, in individuals who had been exposed, say, to severe stress, then you start seeing the dissociation of these alleles. And I wonder, can you comment on that, particularly with regards to serotonin? And then second thing, I'm also going to ask you about you mentioned the 2A receptor, but but what about some of the 1 receptors?
Right. In answer to your question about environmental impacts on that, you're absolutely right. And I'd break down that environmental impact both as an intrauterine impact, actually, and then as a current impact. And I say intrauterine impact because there's increasing evidence that infants born to mothers who've got high levels of stress and or exposed to high levels of abusive behaviours have got very significant differences in socio-emotional behaviours and in terms of fear processing. And that's one of the things that we're looking at in our lab. So one of the questions is what's the neural basis of that and what's the interactive effect of that? And the second thing, as you quite rightly say, is if you've got stressors on at the same time now, how's that going to interact with your genotype? The answer is we don't know, and that's what needs to be done. In terms of the other receptors, there's virtually no evidence out there. Yeah, nothing. It's extraordinary, really.
Very nice review of serotonin. Two points. One is that the SSRI results in autism supposedly very recently have shown that it actually might make some of the symptoms worse rather than improving. I think the two recent papers that have come out. So it's really something that should be taken with caution. The other thing is that you're talking about MAOA. Have you looked at MAOB, or is anybody looking at that? Because that's really the monoamine oxidase. It's inside the serotonergic neurons.
Right.
The A is outside, and
right.
It has some kind of modulation. But the B is the one that you would think would be the big player here.
Yeah, sure. Well, let me just make one statement. As I hopefully made clear, I said that the literature on the use of SSRIs was not clear, and I just reinforce that. In terms of your second question is no one has looked at that yet.
That was great, thank you. Is there any thought that epigenetic changes might have a role in modulating this pathway or environmental factors that cause epigenetic changes? Is there some evidence for it, or is there any thought about that?
Okay. Take the first question first. Would an epigenetic question be of interest in these pathways? Absolutely. That would be one of the key questions. In terms of what's been done in the human literature, none that I'm aware of. But I'm happy to be corrected on that, but none that I've seen.